The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Good friends, good to see you, and welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. Well, we're only 6 weeks into the new year, and already there have been some significant changes in our nation's capital. A new Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, finally has got the job, but only with a slim majority. A new GOP majority in the House, who so far look more like the Keystone Cops than a well-oiled machine. A new Democratic majority in the Senate, so everything no longer depends on that cranky old senator from West Virginia. A new chief of staff in the White House, Jeff Zients, with a hard job of stepping into the worn-out shoes of Ron Klain. And a driven Joe Biden, riding high with new purpose and new energy after last week's blockbuster State of the Union. But nothing in Washington escapes the attention of today's podcast guest, New Yorker magazine staff writer Susan Glasser. Susan chronicles what's happening in Washington in her New Yorker weekly column, Letter from Biden's Washington. And she joins us on today's podcast. Susan Glasser, welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, I'm great. Great to be with you, Bill.
Thank you so much. So your weekly newsletter with the New Yorker, a letter from Biden's Washington. Susan, I guess you'd have to say, we'd often say, it's more than ever Biden's Washington after the State of the Union last week, right?
Well, it's quite something to see how, Biden has a long history of playing a bad hand well. And interestingly enough, he seems to have really, in some ways, the adversity of Republicans taking control of the House of Representatives has given him, it appears, the foil that sometimes a politician needs and craves. And I think he very effectively, used the extreme elements of the House Republicans last week in his State of the Union to show himself as a sort of a presidential figure looming above it all.
Yeah, and I think that with all the reporting about the theatrics, right, the white fur coat and the liar and all that, that there wasn't enough, I felt, people sometimes missed his message, which was to the Republicans, hey, look, we got a lot of stuff done the last 2 years, and we can get some good stuff done and big stuff done in the next 2 years if we work together. I mean, there's this constant call for bipartisanship on his part, which certainly is quaint, Susan, but is it real these days? His call for it is real. Is the reality of it?
Well, that's right. I mean, look, what Biden would say, and I think there's some truth to this, is that it's not bipartisanship as much as it is a kind of willingness to work across the aisle in service of goals that each side supports, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually a somewhat different approach. I think he would say it's actually get done-ship, get something done-ship. And, that Washington in recent years has sort of like thrown up its hand, at the notion of gridlock and sort of said essentially, well, look, what can we do? Things are so crazy and partisan and divided here. And Biden, because he spent so much of his career in Washington in an earlier era when the incentives of politics were fundamentally different, when the incentives of politics were, you had to have a record to run on. You had to show that you got things done. And that provided the fuel and the incentive for Democrats and Republicans, even say in the midst of the very divisive, polarizing Reagan era in the 1980s. Both sides still had the common need and the imperative to produce results that they could then take to the voters. And that's kind of the tradition that Biden comes out of. And I think you're right that there were two goals in that State of the Union speech. One was communicating to the American public, hey, actually, I have surmounted the partisanship in Washington to a certain extent and compiled a very impressive legislative record that you didn't think I could do. And that is fulfilling the promise of my presidency and ticking off the list, whether it's the bipartisan infrastructure deal, the bipartisan CHIPS Act that essentially is bringing significant components of manufacturing back to the United States. It is the climate change provisions in the not necessarily correctly named Inflation Reduction Act. So he is making the pitch for his accomplishments, which is important, by the way, because politically he has a problem there. And a Washington Post survey released right before the State of the Union underscored what that problem is. 60% of those polled, 60%, which means a lot of Democrats as well, said they didn't think Biden had accomplished a lot as president. So he has to communicate what he's accomplished. But then the other piece is, what is he going to do going forward with actually divided government now? Mm-hmm. And that speaks to your original question. Can they actually do anything in the context of divided government? My personal view is they're not going to be doing all that much. But what you heard from Biden was sort of the opening salvo of his 2024 reelection campaign message.
Right. You, in one of your recent newsletters, you pointed out, maybe it was a podcast you do with Jane Meyer and Evan Osnos, that Biden has been, throughout his career, but particularly lately, and particularly maybe at the State of the Union, I love the phrase, lucky in his enemies. He really has, hasn't he? And he was the last Tuesday night.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I don't think that Joe Biden would be president if it weren't for Donald Trump. Let's be clear about that. Remember, he didn't run actually in 2016 after the tragic death of his son, Beau, and also Barack Obama, whom he served for 8 years as vice president, you know, made a very clear-cut decision to throw his support behind Hillary Clinton. It looked like Biden's career was over, capped by, you know, a long and successful run as vice president and his decades of service in the Senate. And it was really the sort of challenge posed by the Trump presidency and Biden's decision that he needed to get into the race to run against Trump that really is the reason he ended up clearing the field, a very crowded field. It didn't look like he was going to do that of Democrats in 2020. And you know, Democrats have been in many ways united like nothing else by Donald Trump. And so there's that hanging out there. And now he has not only Trump as an enemy who's running again, a very polarizing figure who brings Democrats out to the polls, but also these very extreme House Republicans is very effective because he can say it's not just Trump, but the Trumpists that I'm running against.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. There was another part of his State of the Union that, again, might have gotten missed in all the attention to the theatrics, and that was he seemed to want to reset – I want to get your take on this. To me, he seemed to want to reset the focus of the Democratic Party to, you know, we're here – for middle-class America. We're here for the working-class Americans. It was almost like the old Democratic Party, right? You know, let's go back to our roots. And because a lot of those blue-collar workers voted for Trump. He's trying to get them back, isn't he?
Yeah, I think it's really important that you highlighted that. I also thought so. And this is your point also about it's not just the theatrics. It's pay attention to what he was saying. And it struck me that this was kind of Biden in his comfort zone as, you know, I'm just middle class Joe, a guy from Scranton, PA. And, you know, that's always been a theme he struck on and off during his career as a politician. And I think it's one we haven't heard as much from him when he's been president, where he's really focused more on what I would describe as the twin challenges of defending democracy at home and abroad. That's more what the message of Biden's presidency has been up until now. But this sort of much more campaign season message appeared in the State of the Union. It also had a certain advantage, I think, for Biden and for Democrats of essentially kind of stealing some of the populist thunder back from Republicans and kind of making the claim that those Republicans, the Trumps, are kind of fake populists. And I'm the guy who's going to kind of set government to work for you little guy. And, you know, I mean, he certainly sounded authentic when he was railing against, you know, things like annoying fees charged by credit card companies and, you know, telephone
and hotels. Yeah, and airlines. Hotels.
When they're not even, you know, that one of my favorite lines in the speech is when, you know, it's just the authentic Biden, right? When he's like, and they're, you know, they charge you a resort fee for hotels that are definitely not resorts. And I thought, you know, this is a guy who has some relatively recent experience of looking at his credit card bill.
as a lot of us has. So you mentioned the one poll. There were two right before the State of the Union that were I Joe Biden, I would have found them just really devastating. One was that some 62% of the American people say, despite all they've done, and you've got to admit, as you just pointed out, they did do it. He delivered a lot. 62% say he didn't accomplish much in his first 2 years. And then only 37% of Democrats, I think it was the CBS poll, said that Biden should run again. I mean, it's almost like the Rodney Dangerfield of our times, right? Can't get no respect. Wouldn't that just dishearten Biden?
Well, it really is striking. And I do think that is a theme that has run through Biden's career, is repeatedly being underestimated. And in some ways, that's become a kind of a political superpower for him, because it's a lot easier to outperform expectations in many respects, right, in politics. So, you know, it's definitely both a problem and an opportunity for Biden. But those are two different issues. So one is he clearly has a sales problem when it comes to his record. And why is it that his accomplishments haven't broken through? And is that because of the lack of a unifying message? Is it because people don't feel the tangible results of those legislation yet? Is it because they don't care about it or they're worried about other things? So, you know, there's a lot to unpack in why it is that people don't think he's accomplished a lot when, by Washington standards, he has, in fact, accomplished a lot. Then there's the other bucket, which is this question of the notable, pronounced lack of enthusiasm by the American public across the board, I should say. And that does include many Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents, as well as Republicans, who are not enthusiastic about Biden running again and are not enthusiastic about his performance as president. Biden's poll ratings, approval ratings, have consistently been the worst approval ratings of any president since modern polling began, except for Donald Trump.
Except for Donald Trump.
So partially that may speak, by the way, to the kind of sclerotic mood of the American electorate in this day and age, which is to say that it's impossible for any president perhaps to be seen as doing a good job. But I think there's a more specific reason that's not so much performance related that we have to talk about. And that, of course, is Biden's age. And in my view, that is what is powering a lot of the concern and the lack of enthusiasm for him running again in his second term. It's not so much what he's done in his first term as it is the mere fact of his age. At age 80, he's already the oldest president in American history. If he runs and wins a second term, he would be 86 years old at the end of the second term. That is, you know, a pretty significant risk factor to introduce into American politics.
So let's look at the other side of the aisle here for just a few seconds, right? The word that comes to my mind when you look at the Republicans trying to get together on whether or not they really want to cut Social Security and Medicare, whether they really want to stick with Ukraine, with what their economic agenda or their budget deal like really is disarray the accurate word to describe what we're seeing on the Republican side of the aisle?
Well, it is a divided Republican Party. There's just no question about that. And of course, with Trump running again, we know, you know, there's a reason that my husband Peter Baker and I called our book about Trump and his presidency the divider. You know, this is undoubtedly the course that he will pursue as he seeks to get the Republican nomination again, is maximal divisiveness. And there are many fissures, both on policy lines You mentioned already Ukraine as being one of them, very notable that you have sort of Trump and his hardcore followers already, you know, saying the U.S. shouldn't be providing a blank check to Ukraine, essentially offering support for Russia and Vladimir Putin's vision. And, you know, Trump never believed that Ukraine should even be an independent country, which is an extraordinary thing. So you have many potential fissure lines over policy. But also you have a divisive figure. You have division between the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans who are taking a very different approach right now. And I think you'll see a real effort by the White House to take advantage of that particular fault line, especially as they're going through these upcoming negotiations on the debt ceiling limit.
And we know that Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell have both said, no, Social Security and Medicare are off the table. But there are, in fact, as the president pointed out, some Republicans who are insisting that Social Security and Medicare must have to be on the table, right? Which is, we call it the third rail. But that's been a consistent message since I've been around here of the Republican Party, back to Newt Gingrich saying, the Social Security ought to just, we ought to let it wither on the vine.
Right? Well, let's just say that, you know, if you're a Democratic big D politician, you know, this is an approved move in the playbook to go after the faction of Republicans who do believe this. And, you know, that's why it's effective, because there is and has been for a long time a group of Republicans who have pursued these kind of cuts in the name of deficit reduction. And of course, it was under Donald Trump that the deficit ballooned in recent years. And now the government is looking at having to pay the price for that and being very much divided over what approach they should take.
Yeah. Interesting to see Donald Trump himself, right, criticize Republicans who want to cut Social Security and Medicare. So it's all over the place. But it does raise one issue that I'm sure you're dealing with at the New Yorker. We had Carl Hulse from the New York Times, our good friend and yours, on last week, who talked about the fact that even at the New York Times also, they're really wrestling with this question of how do we in the media handle lies on the part of politicians. I mean, stuff we know is absolutely not true. That's a challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look, Bill, we live in a golden age of shamelessness. You know, I mean, look, Washington, any capital city has always had its share of hypocrites and charlatans and, you know, people selling you, you know, a bottle of snake oil. But it seems that, you know, Donald Trump pointed the way toward an era of shamelessness that we could hardly, you know, have believed, you know, would have political resonance. And yet, nonetheless, we're talking about a post-truth world here where millions and millions of Americans fell for Trump's big lie about the 2020 election, including, by the way, dozens and dozens of members of Congress. And, you know, it gets a little bit lost in Democrats' relief at the outcome of last fall's midterm election, which could have been much worse for them. But in a way, they sort of overcorrected. And while election deniers lost many key statewide races last year, you know, for governorships and for Senate races, you know, it can get lost that two-thirds of the House Republican Conference back in January of 2021 actually voted not to certify the election that Joe Biden won without any significant evidence that would be warranting of overturning that election. That is to say that the House Republican Conference today is dominated by election deniers. And this is an extraordinary thing. So you talk about, like, well, what do we do about lies? You know, we're living in an environment in which, you know, certainly both parties and politicians in both parties often misrepresent things or offer untruths or misleading things or put spin on the ball. But we're also talking about not only that regular kind of political lying, but the embrace by one of our two political parties of essentially a massive deception in the effort to overturn election and retain power.
And that that also leads into this kind of wave of investigations, right, that the new House leadership has announced, and they've already begun. I mean, some of these investigations are just total nonsense, right? It seems that the FBI was an arm of the Democratic Party out to get Donald Trump, right? So how does the media handle that? Do they?
I think it's a huge challenge. You know, I've seen across the board, you know, some people won't even use the full name of this subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government.
Right.
They'll say that, you know, on the alleged weaponization or something like that. But one thing I've watching Donald Trump, you gain a new appreciation, and Republicans like Jim Jordan, who have, you know, sort of carried his water on Capitol Hill, you realize how propaganda works and disinformation works. It works not because you expect everybody, and certainly not your opponents, to believe every crazy thing you're saying, but because you set the contours of the debate, because you implant enough uncertainty, enough questions about the person. To this day, we're just listening to a focus group the Never Trump Republican, Sarah Longwell, was conducting. She does this regularly this was a group of 2016 Trump voters who then switched and were 2020 Biden voters. So they're very crucial for the Democrats, obviously, running again in 2024, this group, right? And again, it's a focus group, so make of it what you will. But really notable that so many of the people there still to this day explain their 2016 vote for Trump. They say, well, I just couldn't vote for Hillary. And if you press them, what did they not like about Hillary? Many of them said Benghazi, even though they could not explain, of course, what it is, or that it was an infection. And then even the Republicans on this Benghazi committee that spent years, quote unquote, investigating it, even they produced a report in which they said, well, actually, you know, there's nothing we can really point to. It works. Yeah. Propaganda, disinformation, it works because it implants doubts in people's mind.
And especially works today because of the power of the social media, right? So it doesn't matter if the New York Times takes it seriously or if, right, NBC or CBS, right? They're still getting it out there.
Well, that's right. I do think you're seeing the consequences of kind of parallel, non-intersecting media universes in which Republicans and Democrats increasingly live. And, you know, just if you live in kind of blue America, sit down, listen to a minute to Jim Jordan kind of outline where he's at in any one of these probes. And sometimes it can even be hard to follow. I mean, you need like an advanced degree in foxology in order to pay attention to some of this stuff. It's just a completely alternate narrative. It's not aimed at you and me.
All right. So before we take a break, I just have to, this is the ultimate Washington insider question. I recognize that and I take blame for it. But you know them both, I'm sure. How do you think Jeff Zients fits into the job and the incredible job that Ron Klain did as chief of staff? Is that going to make a big difference in the Biden White House?
You know, I think it's important, and not just a Washington insider question, to ask about the role of White House chief of staff, which really is one of the most important jobs, if not the most transparent jobs in Washington. And, you know, the modern presidency has become very, very dependent on chiefs of staff. I would argue if you look at Trump's four chiefs of staff, that actually tells the story of his presidency in many ways. Ron Klain, Biden's first chief of staff, was an extremely hands-on manager of almost everything. He married the politics and the policy. He was, in some ways, probably one of the strongest chiefs of staff figures we've seen in recent years. Contrast that, I think Jeff Zients, you know, he is hailed as perhaps one of the best managers of his time, just a great leader of institutions, but he's also a technocrat. And I think it really suggests that there's going to be quite a different model going forward in the Biden White House. Biden is expected to announce his campaign for reelection. It's very likely that the Zients is not going to be running that campaign from his perch as White House Chief of Staff, which, by the way, many previous Chiefs of Staff have done.
Essentially,
you know, led the campaign, like Jim Baker, the subject of a biography that Peter and I did. Baker ran Reagan's reelection campaign from his perch as White House Chief of Staff, then returned very reluctantly in 1992 to run George H.W. Bush's reelection campaign from the perch as White House Chief of Staff, leaving the Secretary of State role to do that. Zients is not going to run the campaign. He's going to run, in a sense, everything else. And he's seen as a great manager, but it's a model that sets up potentially some friction inside the White House, you know, issues around communication and who's really in charge. And we'll see. He's also not a lifetime insider in Biden world, which by all accounts is a pretty insular world where the president is very comfortable with people who've been with him for a very long time.
Right. So Ron Klain will be with the campaign. Jeff Zients will be running the government, probably is what it is. And on that point, that leads us right into 2024, which let's jump into after a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod. Susan, hold on. We'll be right back with you. And for today's podcast with Susan Glasser, I want to give a shout out to two of our good labor union friends who were in the news last week, the Iron Workers and the Laborers Union. At the State of the Union address, President Joe Biden had invited a young iron worker, a young woman iron worker, Saria Gwynn May from Ohio, who is one of the iron workers going to be working on rebuilding that Brent Spence Bridge over the Ohio River. She was in the gallery with First Lady Jill Biden. And then the very next day, President Biden went out to DeForest, Wisconsin to visit the training center of the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA, both the iron workers and the laborers, longtime sponsors of the Bill Press Pod. We were glad to see them get the president's attention, and we salute them and thank them again for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Back with today's podcast, our guest, Susan Glasser. Well, she wears so many hats, it's hard to keep track of. She's certainly a staff writer for The New Yorker, writes her weekly column, Life in Biden's Washington. Also, co-host of the Political Scene podcast with Jane Mayer and Evan Osnos. and co-author with her husband, Peter Baker, of The Man Who Ran Washington, all about James Baker a few years ago, and most recently, The Divider, about the Donald Trump presidency. Susan, good to have you back on the Bill Press Pod. So was Joe Biden's State of the Union address, is there any doubt afterward that he's going to, plans to run in 2024?
Well, thank you, Bill. I would say it sure sounded an awful lot like a declaration of candidacy to me, the round one of the Biden for President 2024 campaign.
Yeah. All right. So this week, Nikki Haley will be the first Republican to actually stand up and say, I'm going to run in the primary against Donald Trump. She makes that announcement in South Carolina. Then she's going to North New Hampshire and Iowa, which are still the first two states for the Republicans. How's that going to play out? And she certainly won't be alone, will she, Susan?
Well, that's right. I think it's more the beginning of the actual campaign season that we're looking at here rather than anyone anticipating it's going to be a Nikki Haley versus Donald Trump matchup. Of course, right now, Trump remains the national leader in the polls for Republicans. He remains ahead in almost all surveys, and Nikki Haley, I think, is one of a number of former Trump administration cabinet officials who is sort of stuck in the single digits in most surveys. Now, she has some formidable political chops. She's a former governor of South Carolina, very ambitious. She had not had previous experience at the national level. She very quickly established a high profile out of a job that isn't always so high profile, that Trump's United Nations ambassador. Mm-hmm. And, she's used that to acquire certain kind of national security chops that she, I think, will emphasize in her bid for the presidency, sort of the more traditional hawkish national security pro-Israel wing of the Republican Party is part of what Nikki Haley looks to be calling on for support.
But several Republicans have said in the last few days that if you run against Donald Trump, you got to be prepared, right, that he's going to be merciless in taking you on. So far, he seems to be sparing Nikki Haley and directing most of his fire against Ron DeSantis.
Well, as a number of people in Washington have said to me, in recent weeks, it does look like Nikki Haley is the first out of the gate to announce for vice president. And, there's something to be said for Trump's estimation of Haley is such that he's not directing withering fire in her direction, but more a sort of patronizing, well, she should run if she wants to, mm-hmm. kind of a thing. And that does certainly give you a sense of at what level he estimates the threat from Haley at this moment in time. DeSantis and Trump is shaping up as the grudge match of the 2024 primary season. Donald Trump says, and I think he has some basis for saying this, by the way, that, Ron DeSantis would be nobody without me. Mm-hmm. And it is a reminder that DeSantis was essentially an obscure Republican, far-right congressman in the Freedom Caucus from Florida in 2018 when he ran and was losing a primary to run for governor in Florida, and essentially retooled his campaign to become the Trumpiest candidate in a bid, successful bid for Trump's endorsement. He even, to me, the sort of iconic thing to watch from that campaign was the campaign commercial in which he dressed his infant child in a Make America Great Again onesie, read a story to his toddler daughter, which was how to build Trump's wall, and basically declared himself be the Trump candidate for governor of Florida. It worked. And of course, the rest, as they say, is history. But I do think DeSantis's challenge is being untested at the national level, and yet so much burden of expectation is now upon him. Many, many Republicans are saying they're sick and tired of Donald Trump, not, by the way, because he led an insurrection to overturn the results of the election or any of the other things that he did, but more because they fear that he's a loser. And yet the burden of that disaffected Republican kind of party leadership is falling basically on the shoulders of Ron DeSantis. Well, what if he implodes? What if he doesn't really have what it takes? Then I think Republicans are going to end up once again with Donald Trump.
Is Donald Trump's real opponent in 2024 none of the people we've talked about, not even Mike Pence or Mike Pompeo or Chris Sununu, but maybe a guy named Jack Smith, who is the special counsel looking into both the document situation and the insurrection, Trump's role in the insurrection?
Well, you know, this is where's that
going? In your judgment,
you know, many people have faltered on the making predictions out of the Justice Department. Because remember, mm-hmm. in the end, Jack Smith is a special counsel, but ultimately it actually will be up to Merrick Garland, the attorney general, to make the final call, because he's not an independent counsel. He's a special counsel. He still has to ultimately make a recommendation to the attorney general. And it will be very hard, of course, for the attorney general to say no if Smith recommends prosecuting Donald Trump. That presumably will happen pretty soon, but inevitably it will be tangled up in the politics of the election year. And Trump might even benefit if he were to be indicted. And as you know, Trump loves nothing more than to claim that he's a victim and to offer Americans grievance politics. This would be the ultimate grievance for him, certainly. So, you know, there's that risk factor as well. But of course, there are, you know, many, many Americans who are very frustrated at both the slow pace of the investigations of Donald Trump. It's been more than 2 years, after all, since he left office. And there's a strong sense, you know, among many Americans that Trump has escaped accountability and has been able to operate with impunity, doing things that many other people would not be able to get away with. And so, you know, it's really a political mess for any special counsel and attorney general. But I do think we're headed towards some sort of resolution, presumably in the coming months, one way or the other.
Well, I was going to ask you that. It seems that Jack Smith does have maybe not an official, but an unofficial deadline, right? That he's got to do whatever he's going to do before the 2024 campaign is fully underway.
Well, that's right. Look, that partially shaped Donald Trump's calculation for why he announced so early. And I think that's important for people to note. Like, one of the reasons Trump is the only guy officially announced in the Republican field is that he was determined to do so immediately after the November midterm elections, in part to clear the field of would-be Republican challengers, but also in order to, he thought, preempt the Justice Department and to make it harder for them to issue any indictment of him once he was an official presidential candidate.
Right, exactly. Well, we'll see how that plays out. I have to tell you, Susan, nobody keeps their eye better on the Washington scene than you do. I'm old enough to remember reading Janet Flanner from Paris every week in The New Yorker, and then reading Elizabeth Drew from Washington in The New Yorker. And what a great thrill it is to now read Susan Glasser every week, the letter from Biden's Washington. And you're the best of them all, Susan. Thank you for all the good work you do. And thank you for taking your time to join us on the Bill Press Pod today.
Well, Bill, you're terrific. I really appreciate the kind words and most of all, the great conversation that you offer every week. Thank you so much.
And that's it for today with Susan Glasser. Again, you can catch Susan Glasser every week in The New Yorker and her great, insightful letter from Biden's Washington. Another busy week here in the nation's capital and on American politics in general, with Nikki Haley kicking off the 2024 presidential campaign. Well, at least the second one to join in after Donald Trump. We'll talk about that and a whole lot more with our roundtable reporters on Friday. That's the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. So have a great week, folks. Stay safe, stay healthy, and come back and see us on Friday for the next roundtable on the Bill Press Pod.